plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really excited. We have such a great show today. I have with me one of our ICU pharmacists. I rely on her so much when I am attending in the ICU, and she just brings so much knowledge about everything pharmacology. And now I have convinced her to come on the show so that all of you can benefit from her knowledge too. I have with me Tracy Grues, who is going to talk to us about glycemic control in the ICU, and I'm excited to learn from her. Tracy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So let's start by just telling the audience a little bit about you. What do you do, and how did you get where you are?
I'm the SICU clinical pharmacy specialist at Hopkins and the program director for our PGY2 critical care pharmacy residency here. I am originally from Michigan and moved south for undergrad at the University of Alabama before coming back to Michigan to complete pharmacy school at Wayne State University in Detroit. And then I headed out here to Baltimore for PGY1 pharmacy and PGY2 critical care residencies, and have been here getting to work with great people like you ever since.
Well, that's awesome. We are so happy to have you here. So, you know, I think a lot of folks may not know the kind of pathway. It sounds like you do pharmacy school, and then you probably don't have to do any more training if you wanted to be a kind of general community pharmacist, or you can do some number, one or in your case, two residencies, each a year long. You need to do the two to be in your position, which is to be a kind of a real specialist in an ICU, right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Fabulous. Okay, so let's start really simple, although I think it's a lot more complicated than it may seem. What is the mechanism behind hyperglycemia, and why does it occur so frequently in critically ill patients?
Yeah, so for a lot of our ICU patients, we're really talking about stress hyperglycemia, which is elevated glucose in the setting of acute illness. This can happen when cortisol is released, leading to gluconeogenesis, which results in glucose synthesis, and then also decreased glucose utilization so that the body has a readily available energy source while undergoing the stress response. Other hormones like catecholamines and some inflammatory mediators also play a role in stimulating insulin resistance, all of which can lead to hyperglycemia. And this can be harmful because mechanistically it can lead to osmotic diuresis, capillary leak, impaired leukocyte function. And then from a clinical outcomes perspective, this has been associated with increased infection risk, impaired wound healing, increased ICU and hospital lengths of stay, and even increased mortality in some studies that we'll talk about. And so based on our ICU patient's severity of illness in particular, the magnitude of that stress response can be very large, whether it's due to things like infection or sepsis, shock states, or major surgeries for our SICU patients. And that's also not considering a potential history of diabetes. So patients may already have insulin resistance and other issues at baseline. I think in the ICU, there are also a lot of common interventions that can lead to hyperglycemia, like dextrose administration. So that could be as enteral or parenteral nutrition, or maybe as an IV infusion with dextrose-containing fluids. And then medications. A big example that stands out in the acute setting in the ICU is steroids. So these factors that contribute to glycemic control can change rapidly, which also poses a challenge in managing hyperglycemia, while then also mitigating hypoglycemia in the ICU in particular.
Yeah. So as we thought, much more complicated than it might seem on its face. Maybe I should just ask you, definition-wise, I mean, is there a number above which we say this is hyperglycemia?
We'll talk about kind of some targets, but really in the ICU, I think for quite some time, we've had a threshold of greater than 180. There are some new SCCM guidelines, which we'll talk about. And the threshold for that is now defined as greater than 200. We'll discuss some evidence about where that comes from. I personally have a couple lingering questions, I think, about that threshold. So I think the more commonly or, you know, historically defined threshold has been greater than 180.
Okay. Now, would we expect that every patient in the ICU is going to have some degree of hyperglycemia, or do some people not struggle with this?
Not necessarily every patient would have hyperglycemia, despite probably most of our patients having that stress response, like we mentioned. The reported incidence of hyperglycemia in the ICU seems to be around at least 50% or higher in a lot of these studies. So while it may not occur in every patient, it's definitely very common. ICU patients can also have risk factors for hypoglycemia, which is important to point out. So aside from some iatrogenic factors like intensive insulin therapy or not adjusting insulin when nutrition or medications are adjusted, which we'll also talk more about, patients with severe liver dysfunction can experience hypoglycemia because of the liver's role in glucose homeostasis. Other risk factors are significant adrenal insufficiency, which is related to that cortisol and catecholamine response we talked about as the driving mechanism behind stress hyperglycemia, significant thyroid issues like myxedema coma, or insulinomas, which secrete endogenous insulin. And it's not uncommon to have concomitant factors that affect glucose in opposite or additive ways, which again, highlights some of those challenges of glycemic control in the ICU.
Absolutely. So why don't we do an overview of the way that our management of hyperglycemia has changed over time in response to studies that have come out? Because there's been quite a few and they've been very impactful. We talk about them a lot in the ICU, but you know, it's good, I think, to do a little bit of a review. So maybe prior to 1999, before a lot of the studies we're going to talk about, what did we do then?
So at that point, permissive hyperglycemia that didn't necessarily have a consistent upper threshold was accepted because it was thought that excess glucose was beneficial for boosting the body's energy source during critical illness. This is a similar concept to what was once early parenteral nutrition and overfeeding, where PN was actually called hyperalimentation. And this will come into play for some of the studies that we'll talk about. And then came along some observational data demonstrating that hyperglycemia was associated with increased morbidity, and that led to subsequent more robust trials.
Great. All right. So it was a little bit of the Wild Wild West before then, kind of, hey, the more the better, kind of, we've seen this a lot, right? More oxygen, the better, we used to think, more fluid, the better, and more sugar, the better. So we've come a long way. So there was a big change in 2001. What happened then, and how did that change things?
This was when the Leuven study by Vandenberg and colleagues was published, which was a single center trial with about 1,500 SICU patients who received insulin infusions and were randomized to an intensive glucose control strategy with a goal of 80 to 110 versus conventional control with a goal of 180 to 200. The primary outcome was all-cause ICU mortality, which on an adjusted analysis was lower in the intensive group compared to the conventional group. Patients in that intensive group also had lower in-hospital mortality, bloodstream infections, and renal impairment. And the subgroup of patients in the ICU for over 5 days had shorter mechanical ventilation duration and ICU length of stay. Severe hypoglycemia, which they define as glucose less than 40, occurred in significantly more patients in that intensive group versus the conventional group. And this is a theme we'll continue to see with the rest of the trials we talk about. So I think for some limitations here, this was, again, single center study in SICU patients and predominantly cardiac surgery as a specific subpopulation. So the generalizability of these results to other institutions and certainly to medical or even non-cardiac surgery SICU patients was limited at the time. It should also be noted that all patients in this study received 200 to 300 grams of IV dextrose on ICU admission, and that was transitioned mostly to parenteral nutrition. This is no longer our standard of care for most patients and will come into play when we talk about some of these more contemporary studies.
Great. All right. And then comes 2006. What happened in 2006 and how did that change things?
Vandenberg said, and all right, wait a second. Let me try this again, only this time in MICU patients in the Leuven 2 trial. The study design was the same aside from the population, but the results from Leuven 1 were not replicated in this medical population with no difference in in-hospital mortality, which was their primary outcome. The intensive therapy group did have less AKI, earlier mechanical ventilation weaning, and shorter ICU and hospital lengths of stay, but similar to Leuven-1, that was at the expense of significantly more hypoglycemic events in the intensive group.
Okay. So now we enter the era of much fancier names of trials, right? Where people go like way out of their way to have it be a good name. And so we are going to talk about the NICE Sugar trial, probably the one most people will be familiar with because probably of how easy the name is to remember. And that was in 2009. So what happened there? How did that change things? And what lingering questions were we left with after that one?
NICE Sugar was a multi-center randomized trial at over 40 hospitals and included over 6,000 patients from both medical and surgical ICUs. So a nice example of an intervention being assessed in a more robust way after initial data from those Leuven studies. And then similar to the other studies, patients were randomized to intensive therapy with goal glucoses of 81 to 108 or conventional therapy with a goal of less than or equal to 180. And to achieve that, an insulin drip and standard treatment algorithm were used. And I should note that the mean glucoses in the conventional group in the NICE Sugar trial were around 140, which is where our kind of traditional 140 to 180 range has come from. This study found that more patients in the intensive control group died within 90 days compared to the conventional group. And thinking of some of those other secondary outcomes that the Leuven studies looked at, there was no difference in ICU or hospital length of stay, mechanical ventilation duration, new organ failure, or positive cultures between groups. There were, again, significantly more hypoglycemic events with glucose of 40 or lower in the intensive therapy group. And because there were higher mortality rates in the intensive group, it was hypothesized that that was potentially due to hypoglycemia. So there was a post hoc analysis from this trial, which found that patients who experienced moderate hypoglycemia with glucose of 41 to 70 were at almost 1.5 times the risk of mortality versus those who weren't hypoglycemic. And those with severe hypoglycemia with glucose less than or equal to 40 had over 2 times the risk of mortality. For context, I think it's important to point out that over 80% of patients who were moderately hypoglycemic were from the intensive therapy group, and over 90% of patients with severe hypoglycemia were in that group as well. So it's really this NICE Sugar trial that gave us that goal glucose range of 140 to 180 and solidified avoidance of intensive insulin control in most ICU patient populations, especially with that post hoc analysis highlighting the explicit harms of even moderate hypoglycemia, which I think now we're more cognizant of trying to avoid and then promptly recognizing and treating if it occurs. Some lingering questions at this time were whether there were still any subsets of ICU patients that would benefit from tighter glucose control, and then how exactly to execute this strategy, seeing as we can't put every single one of our ICU patients on an IV insulin infusion, which we'll discuss.
Yeah. And this really, for a long time, was kind of the law of the land, right? I remember learning about this, teaching about this, that this is the NICE Sugar trial was kind of the definitive thing. But we now have another trial called the TGC FAST study. So tell us about that. When was it published and why was it done? It's clearly we didn't think that the NICE Sugar trial was the be all end all because we kept going.
Yeah, Vandenberg certainly didn't because this is his latest work. It was published last September in the New England Journal. And it was done because there were some more recent concerns with NICE Sugar with the high rates of hypoglycemia and that maybe those were attributed to aggressive insulin infusion titrations. Along with that early use of parenteral nutrition in the earlier studies that we've touched on, evidence since NICE Sugar has shown that early PN hasn't been associated with improved clinical outcomes, but has been associated with harm like infection. So the TGC FAST authors wanted to reevaluate some of these issues using an insulin infusion adjusted with a quote-unquote high-performance computer algorithm.
Interesting. Okay. They wanted to try this algorithm. And so what did we find? What did it show?
Yeah. So this was a multi-center study. Over 9,000 ICU patients were randomized, almost half of which were cardiac surgery patients, to a tight glucose control of 80 to 110 or a liberal control of 180 to 215, once again using an insulin infusion. Primary outcome was length of time that ICU care was needed, which did not differ between groups. There were also no differences in 90-day ICU or hospital mortality, new infections, or mechanical ventilation duration. Though severe AKI, new renal replacement therapy, and biomarkers of cholestatic liver injury were lower in that tight control group. Astonishingly, the severe hypoglycemia incidence was 0.7% in the liberal group and only 1% in the tight group.
And was that statistically significant, do you know, or was that pretty equivalent?
That was equivalent.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, interestingly, no difference in that hypoglycemic endpoint. Interesting. So how does this, it's very new, right? This has only been around since September, as you said, but how does this starting to change our management and the way we think about how we manage hyperglycemia?
So in my mind, this study, again, incorporated contemporary nutrition practices where early enteral nutrition was initiated as ABLE and parenteral nutrition was withheld for 7 days in those who couldn't receive EN, compared to nice sugar where patients received that early IV dextrose. I do think that this is an impactful trial. While the software and algorithm that was used was very effective in mitigating that hypoglycemia incidence, I think that those methods of this highly controlled study wouldn't be able to be replicated consistently in the real world, at least not yet, unfortunately. So I think this really, in my mind, is just more evidence to suggest that even in the absence of hypoglycemia, there is no evidence of benefit or role for tight glucose control in the ICU.
Great. I think that's really helpful. So we have kind of buzzed through 23 years of research in the critically ill, at least. But what is actually our recommended blood glucose target range for ICU patients? What do we actually do in practice in the ICU today?
So for quite some time, like we mentioned, the general target was 140 to 180, largely based on the findings from nice sugar. And that was incorporated into the SCCM 2012 guidelines and recommendations from the American Diabetes Association. Much more recently, the SCCM 2024 guidelines suggest against a lower glucose target of 80 to 139 compared to a higher target of 140 to 200. These guidelines note that TGC Fast was published after their last literature search. And while the liberal group's upper glucose threshold in that study was 215, based on the results that were published, it looks like the average glucoses on a daily basis were around 150 with very small standard deviations. So not close to that 215 threshold. So I'm curious to know the rationale for the upper limit of 200 in these guidelines as opposed to 180. And would love if the panel members could expand on that in the future, especially since I'd expect most institutional protocols have that 180 cutoff in place currently.
And are we sticking with that, Tracy? Are we sticking with the 140 to 180 in terms of like our order sets?
For now, we are. Yeah, we haven't had any discussions about modifying that again, because I think there hasn't been really any newer evidence to suggest going above the 180 mark since, again, the average glucose is we're really not close to that.
Yeah. And when they, in this TGC study, when they used this computer algorithm, was that measuring, well, you know, was it almost like a able to measure constant glucose, like a wearable glucose monitor would, or it was just getting plugged into like hourly glucose and then it was spitting out a recommendation?
You know, there's probably more information about that in either their published protocol or maybe in their supplement. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. It didn't seem like it was continuous glucose monitoring based on what they have published to my knowledge, but more so just a really responsive algorithm that would calculate dose titrations. And I think the thought was those titrations would be less aggressive than the ones used in nice sugar, which again, likely contributed to those higher hypoglycemia rates.
Yeah, interesting. I think it would be, you know, I'm sure at some point we will see a trial using continuous glucose monitors because that, you know, almost like a closed circuit where it would it monitor the glucose from second to second and make small adjustments, almost like a external pancreas, right? That would be really interesting to see, but we're not there yet. All right. So what about patients with a history of diabetes? Do they have a different blood glucose target in the ICU?
So in the studies that we've talked about 15 to 20% of those patients had a history of diabetes. and there was no difference in mortality in that subgroup of patients in the intensive versus conventional groups for subgroup analyses. There have been a couple other relatively recent trials, Lucid and Controlling, that have evaluated patients with diabetes and found higher rates of hypoglycemia in the intensive control groups versus liberal, and no difference in other patient-centered outcomes. The new SCCM guidelines don't provide a recommendation on targets in patients with pre-existing diabetes due to inadequate prospective data, but they did comment that in their meta-analysis, intensive targets had a potential signal for increased mortality in patients with diabetes. So I think future research could potentially explore even more liberalized goals in patients with diabetes, especially uncontrolled diabetes in particular.
Great. How about any other groups? Are there other groups that might benefit from tighter control and a lower target glucose range?
We've talked a bit about cardiac surgery patients and how historically evidence suggested that intensive therapy was beneficial in that population. Although cardiac surgery patients comprised 45% of the cohort in TGC fast, which didn't show improved outcomes in the tight glucose control group. Neurocritical care patients also are another population that's been studied. And the new SCCM guidelines noted that increased hypoglycemia in the intensive groups with no effect on other clinically important outcomes were found in each of these populations, both cardiac surgery and neurocritical care. So the guidelines state that analysis of data from those ICUs yielded comparable findings, and patients should be managed like unselected patients in the ICU. And then I will give a disclaimer and say that I am absolutely not qualified to talk about pediatric ICU patients, so I'll spare everyone. But the guidelines do address peds patients as well.
Fair enough. I also am not qualified to talk about pediatric critical care. All right. So let's talk about the nitty-gritty of management strategy. So in your opinion, when you think about how we manage patients in the ICU, so we've talked about kind of what the targets would be. Now, how do we get them there? Do you prefer IV insulin infusions, sub-Q insulin, depends, some of each? How do we make that decision?
You know, I would really love to get my hands on that high-performance algorithm that was used in TGC-FAST because I think that's the best safety profile we've seen. The studies we mentioned are, you know, very well designed, but I think here it's important to highlight that because they all had the same strategy of utilizing an insulin infusion in this highly protocolized manner, it doesn't give us insight into sub-Q insulin regimens that you mentioned, which arguably are more commonly used for most patients, I think, at many institutions. So then we're left knowing perhaps what glucose range to target, but not necessarily how to achieve that. In the new SCCM guidelines, insulin infusions were shown to achieve target glucoses more often than sub-Q insulin, but interestingly had increased hypoglycemia episodes. Overall, this didn't translate to a difference in mortality, ICU or hospital length of stay, or infections. So from a clinical standpoint, I think that supports that tailoring that decision to individual patients and their current status is reasonable. I think practically speaking, the benefits of sub-Q insulin are decreased resource utilization, including monitoring and nursing workload, and the ability to downgrade patients' level of care to IMC or floor status. Downsides of sub-Q insulin is that it's less titratable and potentially less predictable than an insulin infusion, especially considering factors that affect sub-Q absorption, like edema, vasopressor use, or decreased perfusion in general. Repeated injections are also less comfortable for patients and can be disruptive to their sleep-wake cycle. And we know that our patients are already at risk for pain, agitation, and delirium from a lot of other factors in the ICU. So I do think that sub-Q insulin can be safe and effective for a lot of patients in the ICU, but a couple examples of patients I would have concerns about using sub-Q insulin in would be those with severe hyperglycemia, so persistent glucoses, you know, above 250 to 300, those who have rapidly fluctuating or significantly opposing factors that are impacting glucose, where I may not have a good sense of estimating their needs and adjusting that sub-Q regimen day to day, or patients with high severity of illness, since our margin for error is simply smaller in those patients.
Yeah. totally agree with that. So often when we have a patient who is, let's say, difficult to control their glucose, we put them on an insulin infusion. Maybe they've got, you know, a variety of things going on, and then they're starting to settle out. And we'll do a strategy where we have them on the insulin drip. We'll kind of calculate the total insulin that they need on that drip over 24 hours. And then we kind of decide how to transition them to a sub-Q regimen from there. Tell me a little bit about that strategy. How do we convert? What should people keep in mind when trying to make that conversion from the insulin drip to the sub-Q? How do they decide whether to use long-acting, short-acting, how much, the sliding scale, correctional? You know, what's the strategy look like?
Yeah, probably for some definitions to start. Correctional or sliding scale insulin is rapid acting insulin like Aspart or Lispro and is reactive. So the higher the glucose, the more units will be given in response. Nutritional or bolus insulin is also usually rapid acting insulin that's scheduled around mealtime. So three times a day with meals and at bedtime, or ACHS in patients tolerating a regular type diet, or bolus tube feeds, or Q4 hours scheduled, for example, for patients on continuous tube feeds or continuous PN. Insulin and PN can also be considered as a form of nutritional insulin, so actually putting insulin in the PN bag. And then basal or long-acting insulin is considered peakless and acts for about 24 hours, which includes glargine, Detemir, and degludec. So for patients who are on an insulin infusion for hyperglycemia management, and as a caveat, this would not include patients with DKA or HHS, so disregard for those patients. But we generally calculate their total daily dose of insulin on the infusion. But if you were to look back at, you know, any of your ICU patients' course over the last 24 hours, we may have weaned their stress dose steroids, maybe we held their tube feeds, maybe we took them back to the OR. So oftentimes it's unfortunately not accurate to simply add up the insulin they received from the infusion yesterday while all those things that were going on and use it to calculate today's insulin requirements. So in that case, we can look back at maybe the last 6 to 12 hours or so when those factors affecting glycemic control were more stable, and then extrapolate that out over a 24-hour period to estimate how much insulin they should receive as that total daily dose moving forward. While, you know, shortening that snapshot of time can help us be more reflective of the patient's current clinical picture, there also are more assumptions we're making by doing that. So as mentioned, if there are important factors at play that are still really dynamic, or the patient's severity of illness is still very high, keeping them on the infusion is going to be the prudent thing to do. But for patients we do want to transition to sub-Q, once we have that total daily dose of insulin, I generally take 80% of that number as a conservative estimate to account for some of that variation in those assumptions that we're making. And then we can split it as long and short acting or basal and bolus insulin. In the ICU, I personally use a 30% basal and 70% bolus split as opposed to 40-60 or even 50-50. This lets me hedge my bets and not overshoot the insulin glargine dose, which lasts for 24 hours. So essentially, you know, locks us into that decision for the next day. And, you know, I'd have my pharmacist card revoked if I didn't give the plug here that we can always give more medication, but can't take it away. And then correctional or sliding scale insulin can also be used in addition to the scheduled long and short acting insulin, in this case, when we're transitioning off a drip.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right. And we're back. Great. So I think that's a really nice way to think through that process, which we do a lot. So kind of along those lines, if you were going to suggest a kind of practical or pragmatic approach to hyperglycemia management, what tips do you have for people specifically?
I think in general, insulin plans are and should be very individualized and, you know, frequently reassessed. But we can use a systematic approach with some of those practical strategies, especially when considering sub-Q insulin regimens, because I think, again, we probably have a better sense of when to use an insulin infusion, and we just talked about how to transition off. But it's really those other patients that we're considering sub-Q insulin in that I think there are some other considerations that are helpful to point out. First, I'd recommend avoiding all oral antihyperglycemic agents. And I would argue all non-insulin injectables as well acutely in the ICU, since these agents are not easily titratable and adverse effects, including hypoglycemia, can be more pronounced in critically ill patients who have less physiologic reserve than when they may be taking these medications at home. For some general sub-Q insulin strategies, we have several options. We talked about correctional or sliding scale insulin, which can be utilized alone for patients who maybe just surpass the threshold for insulin initiation, which the new guidelines mention is greater than or equal to 180, though previously we had thought that that was 140, like we've discussed, or in patients who have very mild hyperglycemia, or in addition to other scheduled sub-Q insulin orders to supplement additional units as needed. Most institutions have different scales for their correctional insulin, like low, medium, and high. One practical tip is to consider the differences between these scales based on your institutional protocol, because there may be a point where increasing sliding scale insulin intensity alone may not be sufficient to address especially more moderate to severe hyperglycemia, because maybe there's actually only a 2 or 3 unit difference between those scales depending on the glucose reading. For patients who have more moderate hyperglycemia or hyperglycemia that's persistent despite sliding scale, they may benefit from some scheduled sub-Q insulin. Nutritional insulin can be considered for patients in whom nutrition is thought to be contributing to that hyperglycemia. So for example, a patient who went from being NPO to getting 200 grams of dextrose and PN overnight, it's important to keep in mind patients shouldn't receive nutritional insulin if they're not receiving nutrition. So if they're NPO or if nutrition plans change, the insulin plan would then have to change too, which we'll talk about some more examples of. And then intermediate or long acting can be considered for patients who either are on insulin at home, certainly for a type 1 or also for a type 2 diabetes, or if glucoses are uncontrolled despite sliding scale insulin alone if they're NPO, or maybe on nutritional on sliding scale if they're receiving a diet. Patients with diabetes who are on long-acting insulin at home, in those patients, we can consider resuming their home dose or perhaps modifying it within 25% or so, depending on their clinical picture, if they're receiving adequate nutrition. If patients who are on insulin at home are NPO or receiving minimal intake, like trickle tube feeds, we can reduce their long-acting home dose. I usually cut it in half as a general rule of thumb when they're NPO. If we're initiating long-acting insulin in patients who are not on insulin at home, we can calculate that total daily dose of sub-Q insulin they received, similar to how we discussed for the insulin drip transition. In this case, I usually don't adjust by 80% if glucoses are still uncontrolled, but we'll use 30% of that value as the glargine dose or the basal dose. And then a weight-based estimate can also be used or done as a double check. I generally will start with 0.1 units per kilo for an initial glargine dose for a patient. One last pragmatic consideration is what will happen to patients who don't have diabetes, who get initiated, especially on long-acting insulin in the ICU, once they transition to the floor or go home. This, of course, can't always be avoided, and maybe their stress response and other factors will be lessened at that point prior to discharge, but just something to be mindful of if there are potentially appropriate opportunities to discontinue their glargine once they no longer need it.
Right. Is it sometimes we see patients who at home are on glargine 2 times a day, and sometimes they'll tell you, well, I needed so much, they told me that it should be 2 times a day. Is that true? Is there a certain number of units at which it makes sense to divide it or not?
There's no good evidence-based threshold that has been demonstrated in the literature, to my knowledge. There are some practical considerations, though, especially depending on, if patients are not receiving a concentrated insulin vial or pen, if that's how they use it, the sub-Q volume can increase. And so, maybe just from a comfort standpoint, as opposed to efficacy, there's thoughts to split up the dose into B BID or Q12 hour dosing. Some institutional protocols also have kind of, again, just thresholds that they have identified. So maybe at doses greater than 60 units per day, maybe there will be a recommendation at that institution to split things up, oftentimes related to, again, operational considerations.
Okay. So this is obviously a high alert medication. We have to be very careful with it. Are there things to keep in mind that can either make the use of this more or less safe?
Yeah, a few things that can improve safety are using institutional protocols with standardized order sets, which ideally are reassessed with a quality improvement process to evaluate not only their efficacy, but also safety and rates of hypoglycemia. I think all ICU patients, probably in general, and definitely those ordered for insulin, should also have hypoglycemia protocol orders placed if possible, if that is something that's nurse-driven at your institution. Frequent glucose checks are also important. So the SCCM guidelines suggest at least Q1 hour monitoring in patients on insulin infusions during periods of glycemic instability. For patients on sub-Q insulin, most are receiving Q4 hour checks at our institution if they're on continuous enteral or parenteral nutrition, which applies to most of our SICU patients. And then frequent reassessment of those dynamic factors that contribute to glycemic control. So did we hold our tube feeds, or are we DCing or weaning steroids, in which case we may need to reduce our insulin requirements. There are also some helpful ISMP best practices for optimizing safe sub-Q insulin use with a lot of those other operational considerations for institutions and clinicians to consider incorporating as well.
Great. So do we need to think about, or when we think about, how do we manage hypoglycemia? So we know we spend a lot of time thinking about hyperglycemia. We know we want to avoid hypoglycemia, but how do we manage it when it happens?
I just realized I forgot the second half of that question. I'm sorry. Things that decrease safety for the last question
yeah.
that we just
No
did.
Worries. Let's go back to that. That's important too. What makes it less safe?
Things that can decrease safety from a clinical standpoint are aggressive versus conservative insulin dosing and calculations that we talked about. Again, not adjusting the insulin regimen when factors are changing or very dynamic in our patients. And then another thing is inaccurate glucose readings. So we talked about potential variability with sub-Q absorption in certain situations that could impact readings, but then also errors with point-of-care glucose devices themselves or with using capillary or finger stick sampling versus arterial or venous blood are also considerations and things to include as part of that quality improvement reassessment at your institution.
Great. All right. So now let's talk about hypoglycemia. How do we manage hypoglycemia?
In general, I think timely recognition and treatment are really key here. I think institutions differ slightly on their exact strategy, and it may also depend on drug shortage issues, which we have been facing recently. So I'll share our nurse-managed protocol as an example. A glucose reading of 70 or less should trigger prompt management. If patients are alert and can take PO, we have some guidance for using fast-acting carbs in the form of juice or pop. The majority of our ICU patients are maybe not alert or able to take PO even prior to this hypoglycemic episode. And this is also important to note that in a lot of our patients, they wouldn't be able to endorse those classic hypoglycemia symptoms like lightheadedness, irritability, hunger, etc. So for most of our patients, we'd utilize dextrose IV push. We give 12.5 grams if dextrose is 50 to 70 and 25 grams if it's less than 50. And then we repeat a glucose in 15 minutes and then repeat dextrose doses as needed. If glucose is still 70 or less after two dextrose IV pushes, we would hang dextrose containing fluids and continue with increased frequency of those glucose checks. With all of this, I think it's also crucial to evaluate the patient's insulin or antihyperglycemic regimen at that point and any other contributing factors to try to mitigate future hypoglycemic episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about patients who aren't on any of those meds? They're not getting insulin. They're not on any anti-hyperglycemic agents. They're just a patient in the ICU. and they have a glucose of, you know, reading of 65. I mean, we tend to treat that. We give dextrose. But is that what we should be doing? Is that just their body's natural response to maybe being NPO and you know, a little bit of starvation? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think in addition to patients who aren't receiving any nutrition or dextrose source, there are also several hypoglycemia risk factors that we mentioned that could be present, even if patients are not receiving any insulin at all. I do think that giving a dextrose source to patients who aren't yet hypoglycemic, but close to it, especially with glucose is downtrending, or in patients who are at continued risk of hypoglycemia, is a reasonable strategy, since glucose less than 70 is associated with increased mortality. So some things I'd also want to know about that patient is whether we can start nutrition, ideally enteral nutrition if possible. If it's not possible, then assessing their nutritional risk will also help to determine if parenteral nutrition should be initiated as soon as possible. If a patient isn't high risk and is someone we'd consider starting PN in after 7 days in the ICU, those patients who, again, have downtrending glucoses approaching 70 may be good candidates for a dextrose infusion to maintain glucose above 70. And I think it's helpful to keep in mind that more concentrated dextrose infusions like D10 or D20, if the patient has a central line, will give us more bang for our buck with less volume compared to something like D5.
Great. Now, what do we do with patients who are on an insulin pump at home? How do we think about if they're going to the operating room, what do we do with it? And then when might we think about putting it back on in the ICU post-op or not?
So patients on insulin pumps who experience interruptions in their insulin therapy are at risk for DKA. So it's important to have a clear glycemic control plan for these patients peri-op and then once they're in the ICU. Most patients that you all are working with in the OR aren't going to be able to operate their pump at that time. So our institutional policy states that an expected interruption of 2 hours or more warrants some kind of plan for glucose monitoring and insulin provision in these patients. For critically ill surgery patients in the OR in particular, I think the most optimal strategy is disconnecting the insulin pump and starting an insulin infusion, which can be titrated both during the case and then once patients are in the ICU. Then once the patient is awake and alert enough to start operating their pump again, then we can work on resuming it and transitioning from that infusion back to their home pump.
Great. All right. I think we already are seeing some of this, and I think we'll only continue to see more. Any other perioperative considerations for hyperglycemia management?
I briefly wanted to touch on the GLP-1 receptor agonists. Prescribing of those are on the rise, which are used in diabetes as well as weight loss due to their ability to delay gastric emptying, which in turn could increase their aspiration risk in patients who are undergoing anesthesia. I'm sure many listeners are already aware, but for completeness sake, a consensus statement by the ASA suggests that for patients on daily dosing of a GLP-1 agonist, that the dose can be held the morning of surgery, and for those on weekly dosing, to consider holding a week prior to surgery. There's no evidence to suggest optimal pre-op fasting duration in these specific patients, but that potentially could be something to be investigated in the future. And then, as mentioned, it would be recommended to continue holding those GLP-1 agonists while the patients are in the ICU and utilize some of those insulin strategies we talked about for acute management instead.
What about SGLT2 inhibitors? Anything people should keep in mind around those?
Yeah, these are also antihyperglycemic agents that for which prescribing is on the rise, especially for their roles in heart failure management as goal-directed medical therapy. So we see an increased number of patients who are on these and who may be on them prior to surgery. Something important to keep in mind is that SGLT2 inhibitors have been associated with increased risk of euglycemic DKA. Hyperglycemic crisis has kind of been out of the scope of our talk for today, but I think it's something for ICU practitioners to be able to recognize, especially when reviewing patients' home medication lists, especially, you know, in patients who seem to have glucoses that are controlled, but otherwise maybe there's acidosis of unclear etiology. And so that's something to keep on the differential. I think management can be very challenging with that. Oftentimes, you know, we're initiating an insulin infusion and decently high doses of dextrose. Our institution actually doesn't have a specific protocol for euglycemic DKA management at this point, although we are hoping to develop some guidance soon.
Great. All right, let's hit some clinical pearls. So from a nutrition perspective, what are some things that cause hyperglycemia and what increases the patient's risk of hypoglycemia?
So for hyperglycemia, really it's any time that we increase caloric and specifically carb contents. Some examples of this that we've mentioned are increasing tube feeds to goal, initiating PN with a dextrose load, advancing that dextrose to goal in PN, or using non-carb controlled diets or tube feed formulas with high versus low or more moderate carb content. So nutrition changes that can cause hypoglycemia are NPO status or when intake is reduced in any way. So a patient who's receiving nutrition maybe through tube feeds and then becomes NPO for the OR, which is common for our patients as we know, or maybe an interruption in parenteral nutrition leading to a rapid decline in dextrose intake. Another example is maybe expecting to advance someone's diet but not being able to do so. So anticipating that tube feeds will be advanced to the goal rate at set intervals, but perhaps the patient isn't tolerating that and they're still receiving trickle tube feeds instead. Patients are at even higher risk of hypoglycemia if they're receiving scheduled insulin. And again, it's not adjusted based on these changes. So as mentioned, if a patient becomes NPO for surgery, I would consider discontinuing their nutritional insulin and then having their glargine dose, which is something that I would consider for them.
Great. Are there things you look for on the MAR, the medication record, in terms of the pharmacotherapy side of things?
Yeah, medication-induced hyperglycemia is important to recognize. Really, the biggest class that stands out that can acutely cause hyperglycemia is going to be corticosteroids. Some medications like norepinephrine and then our somatostatin analogs like octreotide mechanistically can increase glucose, though I think there's more limited data on the actual impact of that clinically for most patients. There are other medications that have longer-term metabolic effects, but we often don't see that as an acute impact in the ICU. A common question that comes up that is MAR or pharmacotherapy related is the impact of dextrose-containing fluids, including those that are used as medication diluents, and whether switching to something like normal saline would be helpful if possible. So maybe there's a continuous infusion with a medication in D5 running at 20 mLs an hour. D5W we know is 5 grams of dextrose per 100 mLs. So in our example, that'd be 24 grams of dextrose per day. So I do think it's worth actually doing the math to see whether there'd be a benefit in switching the diluent. Most times for me personally, I think the effort and potential confusion of that outweighs the impact that it'd have on glucose, but it does depend on what the patient's ins are and how uncontrolled their glucose is. As kind of a final general MAR-related strategy, I think it's also important to verify that medications are actually being given and when. So maybe a patient is ordered for sub-Q insulin, but it's inadvertently being held for some reason. So having up-to-date information on actual administration will make a big impact in creating and modifying our care plans.
Great. How about communication with the team and the bedside nurse? How do you think about this and its importance?
It's so important. I think as a corollary to checking the MAR to see if ordered medications were given as expected, you know, we could come up with the most optimal hyperglycemia plan ever. But if it's not ordered accurately and as intended, if our nursing colleagues aren't clear on how to implement that plan, and if the whole team really isn't in the loop about potentially unexpected issues that arise, such as the patient not tolerating their diet you know, at the end of the day, the patient may not actually benefit from that management that we proposed. So I think being proactive and clear in our communication and making sure that everyone is on the same page is crucial, just like it is for so many other things in the ICU.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, so important. All right, Tracy, this has been so great. If you could pick three of your biggest take-home points about hyperglycemia management in critically ill patients, what would you say?
I think number one, it's important to be systematic and conservative overall when creating or modifying insulin plans for our ICU patients, recognizing we can always give more insulin and that hyperglycemia is favorable over even moderate hypoglycemia. Two, not all ICU patients need or may benefit from an insulin infusion. So individualizing that decision to consider situations where sub-Q insulin may be considered and how it can be given is important to think about. Number three, we've talked so much about these multifaceted and dynamic factors that affect glycemic control in critically ill patients. While identifying and reassessing those factors is certainly a team effort, I would also encourage everyone listening to lean on their pharmacist for some support, since we are, you know, positioned within our teams to be able to consider these factors day to day and can help make a big impact on managing patients' glycemic control.
Absolutely. Those are so important. And I will say, yes, I mean, I just can't imagine doing this without you and your team. I mean, having a pharmacist, if you have that, if you're lucky enough to have a pharmacist with you, absolutely rely on them. The only other tip I'll add to that is, you know, be careful, because it's you all, Tracy, are so good that it's easy for us to lose the knowledge and skill around this, because we do rely on you all. And I think it's important for practitioners on any level to still be familiar with this. So it's one of the reasons I'm glad we're doing this, so people can brush up on the stuff that you know so well. If you had a crystal ball and you were looking at what's coming down the pike, what do you think? What is the future of glycemic management in the ICU, if you had to guess? Anything you think exciting coming down the road? We talked before about maybe a trial in the future using a continuous glucose monitor. Anything else that you think would be fun?
Yeah, I definitely agree with continuous glucose monitoring and, you know, what the general role of technology and informatics is, whether related to that or advanced decision support tools or algorithms like we talked about with TGC Fast, and whether institutions can incorporate that more into our EHRs. I think it'll also be interesting to see future research on the utility of more specific or individualized glucose targets in certain patient populations, especially as we continue to discuss personalized medicine more and more. So hopefully more exciting information to come so that we can continue to optimize glycemic control in our ICU patients.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Tracy. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Anything fun you would recommend the audience check out?
I recently watched a mini series on Peacock called Apples Never Fall, which is based off of a book from the author of Big Little Lies. It is essentially a suspenseful drama about this husband and wife who recently retired from owning a tennis academy, and their life and their four kids' lives. On the surface, it seems like they are this perfect family, but as the series goes on, that doesn't end up being the case. And I will say, I unfortunately am constantly watching TikTok, and so my attention span for entertainment is pretty short nowadays, but this show kept me on the edge of my seat, so I do highly recommend.
Nice. Thanks. That sounds awesome. I will definitely check it out. Well, we have an audience random recommendation from Paula Ortega, who recommends Atul Gawande's Being Mortal. She says it's a beautiful book that really makes you think about death and the importance of quality of life. So that sounds great. I have not read that, but I do love Atul Gawande. And then my recommendation is a trilogy, fantasy trilogy that I just finished. It's called The First Law Trilogy by Joe Abercrombie, who's a British author. It's really well done. I thought it was, if you like science fiction fantasy, it's not sci-fi so much as it is fantasy, but it's really well written and fun and pretty easy to get through. Just three books, not one of these like 10 book series. There are some subsequent standalone books and then another trilogy I haven't gotten to yet, but you don't have to do that. You can just do this initial trilogy, and it's a pretty interesting one. All right, Tracy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter, we are on Facebook, we are on Reddit, and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money, like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.